Town in Cascadia, you're listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today is Thursday, March 26, 2009. And this is Air Cascadia, long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
The Portland City Council wants to go ahead with grading and excavation at Sorrel Butte because you can live without money but not without water.
Congress passed sweeping conservation legislation yesterday.
And the economy shrank by an alarming 6.3% last year, making 25 hedge funds very wealthy.
Portland area weather today, mostly cloudy, a slight chance of showers this afternoon, highs in the 50s. Tonight, clouds, showers, and temperatures in the mid-30s to low 40s. And then tomorrow, maybe a little rain and temperatures in the 50s.
And first we go to regional news from around Cascadia. Republican Representative Vicky Berger of Salem plans to introduce a bill, get this, to allow the state to buy Portland General Electric and turn it into a public utility. My guest this morning is a longtime proponent of publicly owned utilities and one of the most knowledgeable voices on the topic. Scott Forrester, welcome to Air Cascadia.
Hello, Chris.
So what do you make of this? A Republican is planning to introduce legislation on public utilities. Am I hearing this right?
Apparently you are, and I called over to the representative's office this morning, and she said she just filed it. It's not online yet. It should be House Bill 3467. The difference, she said, is that she was the sponsor back in 2005 of Senate Bill 1008, which did not include eminent domain powers, the powers to take over forcefully property from a private utility. This one does. But I will say two things. One is, Republicans have a proud history of being involved in public nonprofit power, and unfortunately the current Republican Party doesn't want to pay attention to its own past. And secondly, I have great skepticism with this bill, and I think the issue revolves around governance. Who gets to govern the new utility? I believe, if I recall from 05, it was appointees by the governor. Secondly, the other thing is that the Senate Bill 1008 in 2005 was to stop Portland from taking over PGE.
So what, in your view, are the chances of somewhere in the region of people supporting public ownership of our utilities, of our energy resources?
Well, I think many people support public power. In the 2003 Multnomah County People's Utility District effort that went to the ballot, and I was a chief co-petitioner, we ended up getting about 50,000 votes out of 150,000. So a third of the people in Multnomah County, mostly within Portland, supported the most radical form of public power with a directly elected board from citizens in your neighborhood where you have direct control and transparency. So I think it's there. The point is, what are the politicians are going to do? So the question is Representative Berger just doing this to try to gain a leg up on the Democrats by showing that she's attuned to the citizen ratepayers, or is she really serious?
That's the question. Thank you so much. My guest has been Scott Forrester, environmental journalist and public utility activist. Thank you so much for that, Scott.
Thank you.
President Obama and Treasury Secretary Geithner say the nation's economic recovery will be driven mostly by small business. They announced a number of measures intended to make it easier for small businesses to borrow. Portland Small Business Association Chief Harry DeWolf has some standard answers, but it comes down to breaking the backs of lobbyists for Wall Street, agribusiness, insurance, pharmaceuticals, and the military-industrial complex. Other than that, no problem.
And then maybe we'll finally have publicly owned power in the area. Congress passed sweeping conservation legislation yesterday that protects 200,000 acres of popular mountains and forests in Oregon and millions more nationwide. The protections bestowed by the bill are the biggest advance in wilderness preservation in a generation. But will this signal a new era of congressional support for conservation? Depends on the economy. The bill gives permanent wilderness protection to 127,000 acres surrounding Mount Hood and millions more across 9 states. Most are in the West, but some are as far east as Virginia. Will the legislation slow mountaintop removal mining? Depends on the economy.
Mm-hmm. The Western Wood Products Association expects U.S. lumber demand to drop to a record low this year. The Portland-based association forecasts a drop of nearly 30% from last year, the lowest level since they began keeping records in 1955. A weak housing market is dragging down the industry. The association says home construction traditionally accounts for almost half the lumber used.
See, there's no market for lumber. We're getting stimulus money and blowing it on clear-cutting the last of the forest. And at the same time, this could cause us to lose millions of dollars in taxes. Here's how. Well, the federal government is offering Medicaid, education, and other direct assistance to states. State tax revenues are likely to drop by billions of dollars. That's right. This is because many states copy adjustments in the federal tax code into their own to make things less confusing for taxpayers. And the $787 billion stimulus package is heavily laden with federal tax breaks and incentives. The changes could dwindle revenues at a time when states are facing their own fiscal crises.
The collapse of Sacramento River salmon runs that led to the close of coastal fisheries in Oregon in recent years can be largely traced to poor ocean conditions. A recent report from NOAA points out that the salmon were hurt by warm sea surface temperatures and low food supply, but the fish were already suffering from declining freshwater conditions in the Sacramento River Basin, where water diversions for agriculture have hurt fish.
It's all about water. Yesterday, the city, Portland City Council approved spending more than $13 million for excavation and grading work at Powell Butte. A second underground water storage tank is planned to be installed there. More importantly, though, it will give the city time to deal with a federal legal challenge over the city's use of open water reservoirs and requirements that the city filter water coming from the Bull Run Reservoir. My guest this morning has got the facts on the future of water, Gordon Mackay Westfall. Good morning and welcome to Air Cascadia.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me on your show today. I'd like to first mention the 1.1 billion people without adequate access to fresh water, healthy water, and 2.4 billion on top of that without sewer and sanitation. And I find those numbers pretty obscene and scary to realize that the numbers are growing every day, every year.
And what it amounts to is water wars.
Yeah, water wars and that is privatization, and that goes to this World Council that just happened the other day.
World Water Day on Monday, I believe.
Yes, and that is funded by the corporations to let them know that privatization is the way to go. And I can see that going into the future here in Portland, Oregon. I can see that happening with the Bull Run, where money is getting tight, and I think they want to. They're just buying their time, and in the future, we're going to see them push for using it for extracurricular activities and doing jet skis and stuff. We really need to work on our water and protecting it, and that's just where we need to go is start being aggressively with our laws and start being aggressive with passing rules and regulations on how we're dealing with it, and we need to start forming councils and having people take ownership of their water and really start setting the pace for being proactive instead of being on the defensive side.
And seeing water as natural capital of much more value to the human race and to Wall Street. Thank you so much for that, Gordon. My guest today has been Gordon Westfall of the Center for a Sustainable Today.
In Spokane, Native Americans are expressing frustration and anger over the acquittal of an off-duty Spokane police officer who shot a young Indian man. On March 13th, a Spokane County Superior Court jury found suspended officer Jay Olson not guilty of first-degree assault and reckless endangerment. On February 26, 2007, Olson chased Shonto Pete through downtown Spokane and shot him in the head. Olson was off duty and he'd been drinking.
The back of the head, I believe. Now we go to national stories. Yesterday was a great day for the people of Appalachia and actually for all of America. In a bold departure from Bush-era energy policies, the Obama administration suspended a coal company's permit to dump debris from its proposed mountaintop mining operation into a West Virginia valley and stream. In addition, the administration promised to carefully review upwards of 200 such permits awaiting approval by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
President Obama is trying to unify his party behind the central pillars of his spending plan. With his budget under attack, Obama's asking Democrats to fight back against Republican charges that his policies will saddle the next generation with an unsustainable debt. Obama said that Republicans would continue to say we could do better without coming up with an alternative.
And we are trying to get KBOO's reporter Spencer Raymond on the line right now to talk about the economy. Chances are that Spencer won't be able to join us this morning, but let's just review some of the high water marks. Despite a year-long global economic meltdown that only got worse as the year wore on, the world's 25 most successful hedge fund managers raked in a total of $11.6 billion. That's their third best haul this decade. How'd that happen, you might ask? Actually, it was pretty easy. They bet big against banks and the housing market. How did they know how to do that when everyone in government is wringing their hands and claiming that they never saw it coming? Obviously, the hedge fund managers did. Maybe they should have talked to them. I'm betting that this year the hedge fund managers are betting against economic recovery. Watch and see what happens. The other aspect of this whole quandary is, and we have a report from the AP this morning, the economy shrank 6.3% by the end of 2008. That's the worst showing in a quarter century, and it's probably not doing very much better now. So where does that put the same hedge fund masterminds? Obviously, they're going to be betting on the economy getting worse, and the fact that they are shorting our own economy is going to drive it down. We have to ask ourselves, we have to wonder what's going to stop the precipitous fall, and maybe it is the best thing for the whole edifice to deconstruct itself. We'll have Spencer Raymond back with us tomorrow to talk about some of these numbers that have just begun to filter into the periphery of our economic imaginings. Liam.
Yesterday, the war on terror got back up on its fire-breathing haunches. President Obama's administration denied dropping the punchy but controversial phrase for the less snappy formulation, overseas contingency operation. It's hard to picture Rush Limbaugh puffing up like a blowfish and spitting the phrase at slavering listeners.
I don't hear it. So, what's the new administration's plan for Afghanistan? New drone attacks on so-called militant targets in Pakistan are part of the overall review of military so-called strategy there. I'd call it tactics, but if they want to call it strategy, they're the government. Intelligence officials from the United States and Pakistan are composing, and here it is, this is the quote, get this, a fresh list of terrorist targets for predator drone strikes along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, close quote. That's actually a border that you'd be hard-pressed to find on a map or, in fact, on the ground. This is like poking those nations' religious zealots with a sharp stick. That's diplomacy.
This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Thursday, March 26, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Emily Young. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only helps us keep subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. Journalist John Ross discusses the hype about the drug trade in Mexico and Malik Rahim on violence and poverty in the U.S.
Thanks for listening and have a good day.
Just a brief reminder that today we have our monthly listener guide mail at, and we need your help. Come on down to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. It starts at 11 and goes till about 4:30 p.m. usually. There's a lunch of some sort, pizza or something like that. You can call 503-231-8032 for more information, or you can just drop by. We'd love to see you. Remember, we're doing a mailer that's today, starting in in a, well, about 45 minutes or so. You can make it on down here to the station. We'd love to see you. Thanks.
Flashpoints, John Ross confronts the hype around drug wars in Mexico. JR on the Block Report with a commentary on the growing tensions between police and civilians. And Common Ground founder Malik Rahim talks about the violence of poverty and injustice in the U.S. I'm Dennis Bernstein, all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are joined again by John Ross, who perhaps knows more about Mexico and Mexico-U.S. relations than anybody in this country. John Ross today joins us from San Francisco, and let me give you a few headlines here. Here's one that says, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said the U.S. must take part of the blame for the drug-related violence in Mexico. Here we have a lead that says the White House is to send extra federal agents to its border with Mexico in a bid to stem drug-related violence in the region. All we hear now, John, is violence, drugs, and Mexico. Your response?
Well, it's again the same old racial stereotyping. I'm amazed that people are so short term memory that they can't remember the last time the border was militarized. The border was actually militarized in late 1980s, beginning of the 90s. It's been militarized and remilitarized and remilitarized over in time again. I guess the last big remilitarization was when they were bringing troops back from Iraq to contain the immigration outflow that was spilling over the border. So, you know, the border is militarized. Forget it, you know. And there's little that Obama can do at a national press conference saying that I'm going to send troops and more troops and drug-sniffing dogs and whatever to the border that's going to deal with it. This is a hype. These hypes are usually drummed up by agencies in order to be able to up their budgets and make enormous budget requests on the U.S. And they have everything they need on the border, man, you know. That's one thing. Another thing is that, like, hey, the drug violence is not spilling over into the United States. We have no instances of this happening. The New York Times has read a couple of stories about stuff in Tucson, but stuff in Tucson has been going on for years. Most of this has to do with immigration. It doesn't have to do with drugs anyway. And, you know, the scare is on. The scare is on because it's a new administration that doesn't know jack stuff, and I won't say the word, about Mexico. And so, you know, they got to appear that they're in control, and because there is a Congress that's, you know, always looking for ways to do this stuff. 2 years ago it was the Merida Initiative, and now we have this, you know, this latest splurge here going on. But there's no evidence at all that drug violence is spilling over into the U.S., and if it was spilling over into the U.S., I don't know how, you know, how bad it would be. There is definitely a drug war going on in Mexico in the north of the country, and between the drug cartels themselves and between the military. It was initiated in 2006, December 2006, by Felipe Calderon, a president who was illegitimately elected president of Mexico. And in order to demonstrate his aura of authority, commissioned 30,000 troops into drug-producing states in the north to quell the violence. That was really good. The first year from 2006 to 2007, about 3,000 to 4,000 people were killed. The next year, 6,000 people were killed. And so far this year, over 1,000 have been killed. It's about 10,000 deaths. You know, the idea that they have somehow stemmed the flow with this mass homicide is absolutely absurd. Calderon and now Barack Obama, I hear, are saying things like, well, you know, the number of people that are dead and dying in northern Mexico is proof of the fact that we're winning this battle. Huh? You know, the parameters for this thing is just bizarre. The Calderon administration, drug war administration, is completely shot through with people that have been indicted, implicated, thrown in jail, held on high bails for selling themselves to the drug cartels. You know, of course, once you have a drug war bureaucracy in place, the next thing comes is the officials of the drug war bureaucracy. Sell themselves to the drug lords, right? Yeah. So, you know, that's some of the stuff that's going on. This question about spilling over violence, I think, really needs to be investigated. We get these absurd stories that the drug cartels are sowing marijuana in Northern California federal forests. Again, a total absurdity. Why on earth would the drug cartels be trying to move 30,000, 20,000, 10,000 tons of marijuana into the U.S., a very bulky product? The way to try and get them into the U.S. is very difficult and, you know, is very susceptible to detection. When the U.S., in fact, is the largest marijuana producer in the world, you know, there's no need for the U.S. to import any of this marijuana. So those figures are just being hyped out of the, you know.
These aren't Mexican cartels in Humboldt County?
Not the ones I know. Folks I talk to, they can't even speak Mexican. No.
They can't speak. We're speaking with John Ross. John, let me ask you about a little bit more on the hype. We've seen this thing coming out of the Pentagon where the two most fragile countries, most concerned to the U.S. That might fall, become failed states are Pakistan and Mexico. And, of course, you've got Napolitano yesterday saying, no, don't worry about it, Mexico will not fail. You want to talk about this fail thing?
This fail thing comes out of a thing called Joe 09. It's a report made by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Again, money is at the essence here. This is the way you raise funds, saying that Mexico is in danger of becoming a failed state. Mexico is not in danger of becoming a failed state. Mexico, unfortunately, is not falling apart. What is falling apart is the Calderon administration and their ability to deal with this and the drug wars and their governors and their politicians. That stuff is definitely not operative, no. But again, this is a Joint Chiefs of Staff report that has been hyped out of the, you know, when anything is hyped like this, Dennis, you got to ask why it's being hyped. Well, of course, it's being hyped in order to raise funds. Can't control the world unless you make people afraid, you know. Fear is what makes them control, you know, what helps them to control peoples, no. Two things here that I think are important that we hear. One is that, the U.S. is to blame because, you know, they don't enforce the drug laws because more people use drugs and whatever. Well, it turns out that the U.S. last year incarcerated over 600,000 people, more than 500,000 people on marijuana, for marijuana possession. This, you know, is a real indication that the Obama administration has a problem. You can't jail any more people than that number. That number is absurd. That number is, you know, unconscionable and has to be diminished, and the marijuana has to be legitimatized. And so, you know, that's one thing. So when they say the U.S. is to blame because it's the great drug consumer in this situation, there's absolutely nothing that the administration can do about that, you know, unless they want to bust every one out of every three people in the United States. The other thing is the question of U.S. arms going south, which seems to be one focus of this situation. Basically, there are a lot, 99%, I hear 90%, but I'm sure 99% of the arms going into Mexico come from the U.S. Can the Obama administration do something about that? Of course. Will it do something about that? No. This just means taking on the NRA, means taking on gun holders everywhere. And, you know, in light of what happened in Oakland the other day, take a look. Don't you think guns should be automatic weapons, AK-47s, ought to be controlled? But, no, the Obama administration won't do anything about that, of course, because it won't be politically correct for them to do that, and they'll lose support in the crossover community they're trying to win.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with John Ross. He is the author of many books about Mexico, Zapatistas Making Another World Possible, Rebellion from the Roots, Indian Uprising in Chiapas, Mexico in Focus, Murdered by Capitalism, many books, also lots of poetry. John, let's focus just a little bit on the role, on what's happening right at the border, Obama's handling of the so-called undocumented worker problem, and how it relates to all the politics between the two countries.
Well, it's a problem. You know, I mean, we have a depression in Mexico as much as you have a depression here. And, you know, one of the things that Hillary's going to Mexico to deal with is NAFTA. It's kind of a side item in this thing. But as we know, NAFTA has driven the agrarian population off the land. Where'd they go? They come to the U.S. Okay, try to get into the U.S. now. You know, try to get to Tucson, Arizona. It's going to cost you $5,000. You can't come up with that. That's where the violence has come from, actually, in Tucson. People being kidnapped by traders on the border and jacked up for, you know, additional fees that they can't pay. That's what the source of the violence in Tucson, Arizona, New York Times continues to, like, focus on. So you have a definite problem here in terms of, like, what are people going to do? Look, we can't farm our land. We can't get a price for our corn. So, you know, let's go join Cuz up there in L.A. or wherever it is, and they head for the border, and they have to pay these abnormal fees, and some get across and some don't. Fact is, they're always the youngest and most ingenious of younger Mexicans, and, you know, by turning them back repeatedly like that, you're sowing increasing frustration on the part of the population. The administration can't deliver jobs. They have to deliver a million jobs each year. They can't come near that in a recession, in an economy where the U.S. doesn't buy anything. So, you know, at the source of the whole immigration issue remains NAFTA. They're not going to discuss this. You know, Mexico slaps them additional tariffs on about $2.1 billion in tariffs on the U.S. because the U.S. Congress, in one of Obama's stimulus packages, refused to abide by a chapter of NAFTA that said that Mexican truckers could operate in the United States. You know, so that was the first, actually, thing, probably the first move that I would endorse the Calderon administration for doing. We expect to see large demonstrations when Obama gets there, when Hillary is there. The population is very active, socially active, a model for the U.S. People should be looking out for the demonstrations, not by what Obama and Hillary have to say. So immigration is part and parcel of this whole process here. And until there's some resolution where goods and those people who make those goods are able to come across both borders freely, we're not going to have a resolution to that problem.
Are you surprised to see somebody like a Sheriff Arpaio be given such leeway and such power to brutalize in a very public way these workers who do some of the hardest jobs in this country?
Well, it's an outrage. You know, I'm not surprised. You know, this is a racist country. You do have these racist law enforcers, so to speak. In Arizona, the situation is very polarized. You have some really great people working in Tucson, Isidro Garcia, and some of the staunchest defenders of immigration right there, and they're up against this idiot, you know, who does everything he can to play to the crowd and has overstepped his boundaries every day of the week. And, you know, sooner or later, somebody's going to have to put an end to it. But, you know, I'm not surprised at all.
All right. And just back to this drug war, because this is the big story. This is the pumped up story. Maybe we could look at it this way, John. Has the United States government ever done anything of any substance to deal with the so-called drug problem, the drug trade, or in fact have U.S. policies made it worse, and do they continue to make it worse?
Well, I think we have to say that, you know, when you have this enormous force raid on the border, and not just today or tomorrow, but, you know, for years and years and years, what you essentially do is a price support system for drug dealers, you know. And drugs come into the country, of course the price is going to go up because they have to deal with the risk of it getting busted. So, you know, that's had an adverse effect in terms of U.S. users and prices. in Mexico, because the U.S. has arrayed these troops along the border for years and years and years, nothing new at all, the drug dealers have been, the drug cartels, basically have been unloading the stuff in Mexico. The stuff's been leaking out. Mexico now has a substantial drug problem. When I came to Mexico in the, well, I've been in Mexico since the 50s, but when I came to work there in the late 80s, mid-80s, actually, the big drug was, you know, was glue. It was paint. And Sherwin Williams was the biggest drug dealer in the country, you know. And, you know, now people, I mean, I see kids smoking crack. And that really is a result of a conscious U.S. policy to keep the drugs out of the U.S., cost the drug dealer, drug cartels money, so that they would begin selling to the Mexican market, so that Mexico would say, we have a drug problem, we've got to crack down.
Amazing. Now, finally, John, and we can't let you go without talking to you about the formal politics. We have spoken to you extensively about the election steal and about the various people's movements. You have made a study and spent decades studying the Zapatistas now. People's politics, are we going to see more of what we saw in the battle of the last election and also in the battles happening around the country with the teachers and the flower sellers?
Well, I think we have to understand that you know, that struggle is ongoing. That struggle never stopped. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the winner of the 2006 election, had a smaller crowd, probably 80,000 people. In the Zócalo this weekend, basically because it was so hot, people were standing down the side streets. But if you take a look at the picture in La Jornada, you'll see full of Zócalo. He's the only man in the country who can fill Zócalos everywhere in the country. He brings out usually, you know, in the range of 100,000 to 150,000 people each time. This has been ongoing. AMLO's been doing this every single week since 2006. So, you know, that struggle goes on, gets absolutely no attention. People want to believe, or at least Obama in his stupidity wants to believe that Felipe Calderon is a legitimate president of the country, but really, at the root of what's going on with this whole hype that we're watching the last couple of days is the fact that he's an illegitimately elected president.
Hillary Clinton, on her way to Mexico, hires you for 10 minutes of advice. But what do you tell her, John?
Well, the first thing you got to do is, like, take the profit out of drugs, you know? Legitimize them, you know, and you'll see a whole lot of people getting out of the business. I mean, there's a substantial number of people involved in the trade right now as enforcers, movers, whatever, you know, and that's because there's no work in Mexico. So I think probably something that would be a good idea would be to scrap NAFTA and, you know, to allow Mexico to develop its own industries. We need to get people across that border freely and as free as the goods come across that border. And so I would say, you know, instant immigration reform, instant legitimization of drugs, and take the profit out of the game.
All right. John Ross, author of many books about Mexico, including Zapatistas, Making Another World Possible, Murdered by Capitalism, and the new one you're working on now, John?
Well, yeah, it'll be out in the fall. It's worked on. I just took to the cuts. El Monstruo. True Tales of Dread and Redemption in Mexico City.
Okay, well, many books of poems. I love the poetry, too. John Ross, thanks for the good information, important information on Mexico. Please, we wish you the best, and our love is with you.
Okay.
Take it easy.
Okay, be good.
Next, we turn our attention to the crucial and volatile situation emerging here in Oakland and across the country. We're talking about a growing mistrust and gap between the police and the community, and in particular, communities of color. Just before airtime, Flashpoints learned that one of the cops who was shot by Lavelle Mixon on Saturday, but only slightly wounded, has a long history of gratuitous brutality against members of the Black and Latino community in East Oakland. In fact, Sergeant Patrick Gonzalez is the cop who brutalized and murdered Gary King Jr. on the streets of Oakland on September 20th, 2007. Gonzalez has been the subject of repeated abuse claims by the public and has been involved in several killings and abuse of residents. In one moment, we'll be joined by Malik Rahim of Common Ground to talk about this at the national level and other issues. But first, here's JR and the Block Report with an impassioned commentary on the growing tension here in the Bay Area and in East Oakland. Listen to this.
Police 2, Oakland residents 4. This is a commentary by the POCC Minister of Information, JR, of BlockReportRadio.com, and Flashpoints. On New Year's Day 2009, much of the world's attention was focused on the Israeli-led massacre of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip in the Middle East. This story was given a break when the police murder of 22-year-old unarmed black father, Oscar Grant III, killed in an East Oakland BART station, was caught on tape by dozens of witnesses and aired on TV. Ironically, no one knew that these would be two of the first tests of how progressive this new black American president, Obama, is. If you fast forward 3 months later, after the first of a series of Oakland rebellions made the police arrest BART police trigger man Johannes Messerly in Nevada, and after the bailing out of Messerly for $300,000, on March 21st, 26-year-old Lavelle Mixon was murdered by Oakland police after allegedly killing four of them on MacArthur Boulevard off of 73rd and East Oakland. Ironically, thousands of people at the same time Lavelle lost his life were protesting the war in Iraq, where San Francisco police attacked the crowd, but only dozens gathered to see what happened to Lavelle Mixon, who let his actions speak about what he thought of the racial profiling in our community. This time, instead of the Gaza Strip in the Middle East, we're talking about the MacArthur Strip in East Oakland. Instead of the occupation force of the Israelis in Palestine or the Americans in Iraq or Afghanistan, the low-income black communities in America are dealing with the police, FBI, ATF, and DEA, to name a few. Instead of a suicide bomber or a sniper holed up in a building, Lavelle turned out to be a suicide sniper who used a gun instead of a bomb to take out enemies of the community. Now that the rabbit has the gun, the police and the media want us to forget the despair that they now feel, that we usually feel, repeatedly when we are discriminately killed in the streets by police, like in the cases of Oscar Grant, Terrence Merez, Dante Story, Amadou Diallo, Abner Louima, Annette Garcia, Adolph Grimes, Casper Banjo, Anita Gay, Aaron Harrison, Katherine Johnston, Sean Bell, and Gary King. Except in our cases, we know that no police officer is going to serve any real time for murdering members of our community. Now in the days following what some in the black community see as a day of heroic resistance against the police, the mainstream news is going overtime to show black toddlers putting flowers on the police-created street memorials of the four dead officers, as well as old black women crying in one of the scenes talking about how dangerous this East Oakland community has become. The reality is, when you go to the scene, which I did a number of times, you see very few residents of the area, specifically young black males, with any sympathy for the officers, because for decades, Oakland police officers have ran rampant over the black community, including Dunnigan, one of the ones killed, who was a sheriff who patrolled North Oakland, reaping hell on young black males. On the Monday following the latest round in black males versus the police in the game of death that put the stats 409 at police 2, Oakland residents 4, BART officer Messerly's trial was given a two-month continuance. John Burns, the civil lawyer for the Grant family, pointed out how this is another case of Johannes Messerly, who was on trial for the murder of Oscar Grant, being given preferential treatment. Messerly's legal strategy seems to be to use the continuance so that all the pro-police sentiment that is drummed up by the mainstream media over the next 2 months can be used to prejudice a jury in Messerly's case to show, quote-unquote, how dangerous these black males are. If these two cases are unrelated, like people in the San Francisco Chronicle have been saying, Oscar Grant and Lavelle Mixon, then why has Messerly's trial been put off for so long? If you look at the edition of Time magazine, which features Obama on the cover and reports on him being sworn in, you will see that the rising tension between the residents of Oakland and the Oakland police has been a national story, at least since the beginning of the year. And from America's first black president, you have heard nothing specifically about Oakland. But you have heard about his stimulus bill, which has $1 billion slated for putting 100,000 more police on America's streets. If the city of Oakland is scared now, they should be scared of when that money is dispersed, because that is 100,000 more chances that a black male who is politically and economically disenfranchised will commit, quote-unquote, revolutionary suicide, to quote one of the revolutionary icons from Oakland, Minister of Defense Huey P. Newton of the Black Panther Party. To all the three-strike supporters, police sympathizers, and prison industry businessmen, how does it feel when the rabbit has the gun? Welcome to East Oakland.
JR and the Block Report. on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Malik Rahim, founder of Common Ground, who has seen this story from many different angles over many years emerge and has seen, I know, Malik, you've seen the deadly turn of this story on the community where you come from in the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. I want you to respond to what you heard.
Well, I mean, it's just ironic that J.R. used the phrase when the rabbit have the gun. It's just a phrase that I used when I was confronted by vigilantes. You know, it is just sad that this can happen, you know, that this have happened. And if nothing is done to put it in check, will continue to happen. In the aftermath of Katrina, you know, I saw 19 young men by the splattered all over the streets of New Orleans. Nobody cared. Nobody cared. No one did anything. It took the Nation magazine, and 3.5 years later, a guy by the name of A.C. Thompson, to finally call and do a full investigation of it. He found 11. You know, they wasn't all in Algiers.
11 police.
11 bodies.
11 bodies.
Yes. But, you know, nothing was done. And there wasn't no fanfare. Why? Because most of the time it was with this and that case and in this case, we're talking about young African-American men. And most of them have a record. And the saddest part about it, those records begin with a nonviolent offense. And we take people and incarcerate them on a nonviolent offense, put them in the most violent environment, not to rehabilitate them, but to punish them. And we do not expect this to happen. You know, I mean, if we was just look at his history, look at his history. At many times, I can just clearly tell you that he called out for help and never received it. You know, I watched this in New Orleans. I watched this. I've seen young men who did heroic deeds during the aftermath of Katrina, did rescues, made sure people's homes wasn't broken into and businesses wasn't broken into, made sure that people had water, ice, food, to last them until this government finally got its act together. And right now, in the midst of a construction boom in New Orleans, they cannot even find a job. So it's not just something that's happening out here or in New Orleans. It's happening all over America. And we must address it. We can no longer just keep this kicked under the rug and expect that it's going to, some kind of way, it's going to come to some kind of conclusion, because it will not.
You and I were sitting at that rally on Saturday trying to have a discussion as the cops were rioting, and they were coming across the street and attacking protesters, and we were getting pushed at, but these cops, we know, they were riled up because four of theirs got hurt, and so they hurt a lot of people. J.R. referred to this in the commentary. Now, what happens to 30 years of suffering because four cops are attacked because the community is terrified and terrorized by a racist, and we do call it on this show, injustice system that works on how much money you can put into it. Well, so where does this go?
That's the American way. You know, it's all about greed. That's the reason why we're in this financial mess that we're in now. Some may say that it's a recession. I think it's a deep repression. I believe it's going to be one that's going to equal the one of the Great Depression of the 30s, up to 1929 and the early 30s. But I think that we need to learn. We need to understand that in the midst of the last depression, that people emerged that stood fast for peace and justice. the Honorable Marcus Garvey, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Upton Sinclair, Huey Long, all great honorable men, those soldiers who did the Bonus March, who really brought the first integrated movement, you know, back to America. I mean, you had these individuals that stood up, but now we must stand up. Just like they became the conscious of the last Great Depression, we must become the conscious of today. We have been in this dormant state of prosperity, unconcerned of how wasteful we are, you know, just living this lavish lifestyle, you know, thinking that this gonna always be the American way, and it will not. You know, we cannot be 5% of the world's population, utilizing almost 30% of the world's resources and causing about the same amount of the world pollution. We cannot go on this way. We cannot go into wars and just say, well, we're going to end it, and then we start a peace movement and tell them, let's get our troops out. But look what we leave behind. We left behind in Vietnam a toxic mess. We left behind, because again, we are a country that love our soldiers, but we also are a country that hate our veterans. You know, so again, you know, we have a history of this. You know, now we are talking about getting out of Iraq. But nobody's talking about how we should go back in there and clean up this mess, how we untook the cradle of civilization and made it probably the most nuclear-active nation on this planet. No longer do we talk about the depleted uranium shells. No longer do we talk about the traumatic effect that we are leaving on the people over there. So again, we got to come together.
Speaking with Malik Rahim of Common Ground. Now, Malik, I wanted to, and we were talking about police power and police abuse at a direct, overt level where you've got a force willing to kill the community it's supposed to protect. And there's another kind of police power, and it has to do with the federal government using agents and infiltrators to undermine people doing good work, such as the work that you do on Common Ground. And I've been wanting to ask you about this. We don't have a ton of time, but it's very important, and it's the other side of the story of East Oakland. Your organization, Common Ground, was heavily infiltrated by a now self-admitted FBI informant infiltrator named Brandon Darby. He was on this show at least twice. Now, when we talk about, you know, being infiltrated, could you imagine that somebody could actually be working inside KPFA that could also be working for the federal government? Oh, Dennis, you're paranoid. No, well, paranoia is unjustifiable fear. We have righteous fear about what the federal government is willing to do to undermine good work. Tell us about Brandon Darby.
Well, again, Brandon Darby was one of the co-founders of Common Ground, you know. And he wasn't only a paid informant, but he also was a paid provocateur. You know, many people wind up leaving Common Ground in disgust because of their interaction with Brandon. My own son left in disgust because of Brandon. So again, and it shows that...
How did he do that? How did he provoke?
My son just told me, he said, Dad, something is wrong with him. Something is wrong with him. He's doing, you know, every time there's chaos, he is in it. Every time you turn around, he's trying to get up to you to be too close to you, something is wrong. My son was so convinced that he was an agent that he went and searched his possession to find out something that he could show me to convince me that this man was an agent. But the last thing I can understand the government coming in to watch to see what we are doing. You know, maybe they could learn. But to come in to destroy, I never thought it would be illegal to serve people in the aftermath of a major disaster. I never thought that would be illegal in America. But then again, we're talking about the same nation that after the same disaster decided that a certain race of people could not find refuge in certain parts of America. So when we lead this, then everything come about. When you look at the fact that we allow the Patriot Act to exist, and without trying to, should be a mass movement to repeal it, because it takes away all of our constitutional rights. Then, and when you look at the fact that the same thing happened in the aftermath of during the Civil War in Chicago. You know, so it's not the first time. So it always happened. But how can you ever say in America, you know, that there is not a Brandon Darby? Because he is everywhere. He's everywhere that people stand up for peace and justice. There's a Brandon Darby. And it's sad that this have to happen in America. It is sad that this young man, you know, a young man that I loved, you know, had to turn to such dastardly deeds, and not for patriotism, because he was a paid informer. He did this for 30 pieces of silver, and there's many of them that is out here. There are not, I mean, he was just one that we found out in common ground. But they don't work alone. They don't work alone. And if this, and then when you look at what happened to us, who was the Brandon Darby and the People Hurricane Relief Fund? Who was the Brandon Darby and the other grassroots movements that was trying to establish not only in New Orleans but throughout the Gulf Coast region in the aftermath of Katrina? So it wasn't just him.
And we do know it was him, the Brandon Darby, who was in police state of St. Paul during
That's
the
right.
Republican
That's
convention,
right.
where the police were even getting involved in torture,
right.
among other things, with the support of the Republican National Committee. And there he was. Which journalists
one.
I know.
Yes. I mean, it was the same one that was also in New Orleans when we was protesting what they was doing to residents in public housing. All of a sudden, this fictitious flyer emerged saying that for every unit of public housing that is demolished, one unit of condo is going to be burned down. It is the same pattern.
All right, now let's go. So in terms of being a provocateur, let's talk about that. So he provided a leaflet that suggested that there would be violence, a violent response to a particular
right.
building
yes,
structure.
At least in that.
Did he do that more than once?
That fly emerged then. No, but I'll tell you what else he did. He created havoc at the largest housing component that we had at St. Mary's.
How did that happen?
He started spread an allegation that the priest that was there, Father Bart, was a pedophile. Then he started bringing in crack addicts and others to create an atmosphere of distrust until eventually we had to close the place down.
What was so dangerous to the government that they needed this action disrupted? How do you explain that?
Well, in the aftermath of Katrina, to be critical of FEMA and FEMA lack of response, it was also to take upon the wrath of Homeland Security. And when you took upon the wrath of Homeland Security, it went back to doing its most dastardly deeds, COINTELPRO, Katrina style. And Brandon Darby was directly in the mix. But then he was not working alone. He was not working alone. And that's the sad part of it. That's the sad part of it. That if you are critical of this government response, is this free speech? That you have a Brandon Darby? That you have him to sit around and not as to spy, but to destroy? You know, I mean, it makes you look at, you know, across your shoulder at everything.
So, and it's that old sort of COINTELPRO.
That's what
you know. Play both ends to the middle, disrupt,
and
suggest violence that the community is engaged or planning to engage in violence. And this is now a self-proclaimed agent of the government of the United States, who, again, my brothers and sisters, was in St. Paul, where the police violence and every level of security force was there, and where we saw, you know, the implementation of the Patriot Act at the local and state level there. And there's still terrorism trials going on as a result of probably his infiltration. But we have a minute left, but this dialogue that we have, Malik Rahim, is ongoing. And it continues. And I made you a promise before we went on the air that we're going to figure out a way to bring flashpoints down to the lower ninth ward, and we're going to do a week or two of broadcasting from your neck of the woods.
Well, why don't you look at between August the 29th and September the 9th?
Well, okay, we'll look at the schedule.
You know, that's the time that not only will be the 4-year anniversary of Katrina, but also the 4th anniversary of Common Ground Relief and Common Ground Health Clinic.
We'd love to do that.
Okay.
Malik Rahim, as always, we appreciate having you with us.
It's always an honor.
Very enlightening. We want to hear more and more about Common Ground and know about your multiple struggles to help the people in your community, despite the police state that we have to deal with. People don't like me to say that. I get lectured every time they say that, but yes, it depends who you are. For some people, this is definitely a police state. That's it for Flashpoints.
Thank you.
Wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs each weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barris-Friedman. Contributing producer, Robert Knight. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina, our roving producer. And JR and The Block Report contribute to this program.
Sponsor Al Andalus Ensemble's Baghdad and 21 Strings concert and CD release Saturday, March 28th at 7:30 p.m. The Baghdad performance is a musical memorial to all the people whose lives were lost or destroyed in the war on terror. Al Andalus Ensemble is steeped in tradition, merging classical, jazz, and contemporary music with sounds from the Middle East, North Africa, and Spain. That's Al Andalus Ensemble's performance 21 Strings, March 28th. At Reed College's Hall Auditorium. More information is available by email, music@andalus.com, that's andalus.com, or by phone, 503-230-2379.
That document cannot meaningfully be described without revealing classified information.
The Bush administration hid behind the state secret's privilege to spy on the American people. President Obama promised change, but recent court battles suggest the threats to our civil liberties will continue. Will the Obama administration continue to use the privilege of the presidency to hide unconstitutional actions from the public? We the People talked to Portland attorney Tom Nelson earlier this week to discuss how a local case of illegal spying could shed some light on the future of government surveillance on Americans. Join us this Thursday evening at 6, when We the People will take your calls to explore these questions and discuss your concerns. Listen and tell us what you think. We the People, last Thursday at 6 p.m., www.kboo.fm/we the people.
you are listening to KBOO Portland. This is a Thursday morning radio zine for Thursday, March 26th. Coming up next, Between the Covers writer Ian Lee discusses her first novel, The Vagrants, with KBOO's own Ed Goldberg. At 11:30, Karen Coulter of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project talks with Ava Lake about saving trees in eastern Oregon. All that coming up on your listener-sponsored community radio. Thanks for supporting KBOO Portland. And I almost forgot, we're having a mailer today, everybody. Come on down to 20 Southeast 8th. We'd love to see you. We need help with our mailing. It starts, right now, 11 o'clock and goes till 4:30 p.m., and usually you get lunch with that. So come on down, call 503-231-8032 for more information, or just come on by. Hope to see you.
My name is Ed Goldberg, and as soon as I get my chair set here, I will sit down and introduce an author, Ian Lee. Ian, welcome to Portland.
Thank you very much.
I notice you're using the Western, your family name second, rather than Lee Eun.
Yes.
Did you do that when you came to this country?
Yes, only because, it's confusing if I put my last name first.
Yes, and when your publicist got a hold of me, I said, so her name is Lee? And she said, no, it's... The title of the book is The Vagrants, and it's published by Random House. And this is a story of 1979 China in the aftermath and still in the throes, really, of the Great Cultural Revolution, although Mao is already dead by a couple of years. But the first question I have is, and I normally don't ask this because it becomes obvious from reading it, why did you title this The Vagrants?
It's very interesting. I'm sorry, I'm blabbering.
That's all right.
The characters, in a way, were all locked in this place. In a way, in 1979, for a long time, most Chinese people did not have the freedom to wander around the land. So they had to stay where they, had the legal rights. However, I had a couple of characters in this novel who made a living by garbage collecting, and they did not have legal rights to live anywhere. And I was very fascinated by this couple story because I read it in the news somewhere in China. There was this older couple who...
This would be the Hua in your book.
Hua, Mrs. Hua and Mr. Hua, yeah. And in the real news, they were garbage collectors, and they brought up 37 baby girls who were deserted. And it was very hard.
37.
Yeah. And it was heartbreaking because when the girls turned 6 and 7, the government would come in and say you did not have the right to bring up these baby girls because they did not have birth certificates or, city residence. So the girls would be taken away from them for orphanages. But still, the couple just did not lose hope. And, over 40 years, they brought up 37 girls. And I really loved that story. And I thought I would use that couple as an anchor for the novel. So you see, when their story comes into the novel, their story threads through the novel about their 7 girls. And so in the end, I think I named the book after these 2 characters. But also, they did have the freedom to wander. But in the end, I think the other characters were all sorts of vagrants because, they did not settle down in their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a novel, but it's about China at a very desperate time in its existence, modern China. And I'm constantly tempted, I'm going to do it now, to run off onto tangents. Because since I know several people who have adopted Chinese baby girls, the idea of abandoning a female child in China was, I don't know if it was frowned upon officially, but it was done widely. And the reason I think that most children adopted from China are girls is that nobody wants them. Is that true?
I don't know how true it is now. It is probably still true because you probably will find more girls in orphanage than boys. But when we grew up, around the time when the novel took place, it was rather, I guess, wide widely done in smaller cities or in rural area, I think, in a way. People did want boys more than they wanted girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's still the official one-child policy in China?
I think the policy has relaxed a little. But officially, I think one-child policy is still in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your book has a lot of characters, and I had to write a bunch of them down. I know I didn't get everybody, but let's start with, as the book does, with Teacher Gu and Mrs. Gu. Teacher Gu is a teacher. He has been teaching in this town for a long time, although he's retired now, I believe.
He just retired after the execution of his daughter.
And that's what's happening. On the very first day of the book, we have Gu Shan, the daughter, being executed as a counter-revolutionary. How did she wind up in that predicament?
That was a very bizarre story. Again, I learned a little bit from history, but she had one time been a frantic Red Guard, and somehow, she was tired of being a loyal follower of Cultural Revolution. So she renounced her faith in Cultural Revolution, in communism, and she wrote a lot about her doubts in a letter to her boyfriend, and her boyfriend turned her letters into the government, and she was imprisoned for 10 years. And while she was in prison, she kept writing, and she kept a journal, and she kept writing letters and arguing for herself, and that got her a retrial. And she was retried as a counter-revolutionary, and she was sentenced to death after that trial.
The great proletarian culture revolution in China. China's had a long, long history, better than 5,000 years as a culture. Mm-hmm. They've been through a lot of ups and downs. Is it fair to say that one of the worst things that ever happened to China was the great proletarian culture revolution?
I would say in modern history.
In modern history, yeah.
Yeah, if you look...
I guess Genghis Khan was pretty bad also, yeah.
Right,
but yeah.
Right.
But this, the excesses of the Cultural Revolution and the Red Guards were worldwide stories and horror stories mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And this, although I guess some of the fire has gone out of the Cultural Revolution by this point in 1979, everybody's living with the aftermath of it.
Right. So 1979 was a very interesting year in China. That was when China started to develop economy and technology and started to open its gates to the West.
Was Deng Xiaoping?
Deng Xiaoping just came into power and it just started, the reform. So it was, by the time, in 1979, people very much wanted to leave the history behind and started a new life. But history came back, haunting you in this and that way. So you could see in the novel that history actually did come back to haunt these people.
To me, anyway, the heart of this book was Nini and Bashi. And I suppose you planned it that way cleverly, yes. You're smiling and nodding your head. The characters in this book are very compelling. The relationship between Bashi and Nini is... the part that compelled me the most, the thing that kept me going through the book, wondering how this thing was going to end. And I don't want to get too overly philosophical here, but it occurs to me that Bashi, at 19 years old, a very screwed up kid, is in some way a metaphor for the entire experience of the Cultural Revolution, just wrapped up in one body.
That's very interesting. I did not think of it that way. But also, I agree, he was screwed up.
Oh, yeah.
And... He was troublesome in a way that I think he represented both the very good and the very bad things in human beings. Maybe that was also what Cultural Revolution did.
Great intentions, but terrible in the way everything was executed. So.
Yes, and that was probably what Cultural Revolution did to human beings. They brought up both the very good and very bad things within human nature. So I liked him as a character. No, I don't like him
as a person.
As a person,
it was
horrible. Right.
Well, let's start with Nini though, because Nini, I loved Nini.
Oh, thank you.
She's a 12-year-old girl. She's a victim of birth defects. She's physically, she has her hands and her face, one leg, are deformed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm almost hesitant to use that word anymore. It sounds so politically incorrect to say that, but. And as the oldest child in her family, you would think that she would have some authority or, some status. But because she's deformed, she's everybody's whipping girl in her family. And she gets no respect anywhere except in one place with the Huas. Tell us about her relationship with the Huas.
It's, you know, the Huas were the garbage collectors who would collect baby girls. And by then, by the time they met Nini, they had lost their daughters, you know, to the government, to the orphanage, and to early marriages. And I think they recognized right away she was an unwanted girl. And they were, you know, they were affectionate with her, and they really wanted to be with her in a way, just to be tender with her, which she did not understand. And she somehow took it for granted. You know, she got food from them. She was fine with that. But she did not understand. And when she did understand, that was, to me, that was the hope of the novel. She got freedom from the Huas, and she was going to be one of the vagrants, you know, with Huas, and she was going to be their daughter in the end, you know, see to their end. So they had a relationship in the end, yeah.
You tell us in the book, though, that Nini, any act of kindness or any act of cruelty was random to her. It was just there. It happened or it didn't happen. She had no way of knowing whether somebody would be cruel or kind to her. So she just accepted that her lot in life was not to know what was going to happen from minute to minute.
Right, and she would not analyze anything. She, you know, she was the kind of the person who would just live in a bad weather, and she would not question, you know, why is it raining today or why is it stormy. She would just say, you know, I'm getting wet, but yeah, so well, I'm going to just
everybody
stay wet.
Gets wet. Yes, yeah. The rain falls on everyone.
Yeah.
Bashi is a red seed. He's the son of a hero, a Chinese hero who died in the Korean War, I believe.
No, he did not die in the war. He died of tonsillectomy.
Oh, that's right. After being a hero in the war. That's right. I forgot that. The funny detail. It's a kind of... It's wry and a bit cynical. I found a lot of that in the book, that you have a certain amount of cynicism about the Cultural Revolution and about the its effects. Is that true?
Well, your life is, you know, like that.
So he's living on a pension with his grandmother. I don't know. I forget what's happened. Oh, his mother married and moved off to another city, right?
She just, you know, left him.
Right. With good reason, I think, probably. His grandmother is a sweet old lady, but she's very old and she doesn't get out much, and she can barely do for herself.
Right.
And he's 19 years old, and he has, at the beginning of the book, one burning desire, and that's to see a naked girl.
Yes.
What's wrong with Bashi?
You know, it's very interesting. What's wrong? Nothing wrong. He's just curious. The thing I look at it, you know, he's not right to have, you know, I would say it's very odd he has that desire, but also it's very understandable.
Oh, yes. It's normal for
because
a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old.
Exactly. And I observe my children, 7 and 4, and they have all these, you know, human body encyclopedia, and they will look at human bodies, you know, in a very inquisitive way. But for Bashi, he grew up in this time that no knowledge was accessible to him. And, of course, he was curious about women and girls. But he also, with good intention, and he wanted to love a girl. And he wanted to love a girl in a way that he wanted to understand how a girl was made differently than himself. So that's how he started.
Yep. Let me remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Yun Lee, and her first name is spelled Y-I-Y-U-N, last name L-I. Title of the book is The Vagrants, and it's published by Random House. But Bashi's curiosity is morbid. One of the ways he's satisfied is to try to find these abandoned baby girls and look at them and try to get some idea of what an older girl or an older woman would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, he fixates on Nini.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
He had this long scheme of, you know, either, you know, in like seducing a little girl with candy or going to, you know, a woman's bathroom to like look at
spy
it,
at
spy
the
on it.
Yeah.
But of course, he did not carry out any plan. But then, bam, Nini came into his life, and he realized, despite, you know, nobody loved Nini because everybody thought Nini did not look pretty. And all of a sudden, it dawned on him that Nini was a girl, and he could, you know, use that information a little. So he started with this very, not very honorable intention of, you know, maybe just to get to know Nini a little. And he made friends with Nini, and he fed her. You know, he brought all these presents to her. But somehow Nini became a real girl when she was, you know, with him, in the way that she became a real self. She became much freer to express her feelings, you know.
She never had anything to think about before she met him.
Right, right. And he was intimidated by this, all of a sudden, by this real girl, and somehow he fell in love with her. And it was a very bizarre love story to me, but it's a love story.
It is. And the thing I keep thinking about Bashi is that every time he does something nice, it's not always from the best of intentions. He's a person of mixed motivations always.
Right, right. And every time he wanted to do something like bad, every time he wanted to do something good, he actually also did something horrible. I think, you know, he wanted to solve this mystery of this man who would, you know, this town's sadistic janitor, but he wanted to take care of the dog, the bad dog, but then he took care of the good dog, you know, in a way.
Oh, we haven't talked about Tang yet. We'll talk about Tang in a little bit. The first time we meet Nini, mm-hmm. in the book, it's heartbreaking because old Mrs. Hua, who the trash collector, the street sweeper, has been given a job to put up the posters announcing the denunciation and execution of Gushan. Mm-hmm. And she's putting the posters up on the wall with flour paste. Mm-hmm. And Nini is so hungry that she begs old Mrs. Hua for the flour paste to eat pieces of it. And finally, the old woman feels so bad for her. She rolls up one of the posters into a cone, pours some paste into it, and says, make sure you throw away the poster because you don't want to be seen using this as a cup.
Uh-huh.
That's so sad. I mean, did this come strictly out of your imagination or...
Well, not strictly out of my imagination. It's very interesting. I read that part in a book fair in Edinburgh, and an older woman came afterwards and said, well, you don't look like someone who knew hunger. How did you write that? And I thought, well, you don't know if I know hunger or not. So when someone is hungry, anything edible is, you know, is desired. Mm-hmm. And that I know, you know, from experience. So it made sense to me when she was so hungry and she would scrape the paste off the poster.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't have to be a chicken to know what an egg is either.
That's true.
Let's talk about Tang. Tang is a country boy.
Yes.
They live in a town called Muddy River. Mm-hmm. Muddy River is an overgrown village. It's grown because people were sent there to work. Mm-hmm. There's a cement factory there or something.
There are a lot of factories.
So this is it's a made up town. It's a mm-hmm. town that was built pretty much from the ground up just to house the workers. And he came in from the country and he feels like a fish out of water. The kids in school make fun of him. They call him garlic breath and mm-hmm. things like that. And so he's a loner and he's a good kid. He just can't get any traction with the people there. Mm-hmm. And his only friend is a dog named Ear, E-A-R. I'm sitting here thinking, did she dog ear? Is this a pun or something from a book person?
Oh, wow. I did not think about that.
So why ear? I mean, everybody who knows him and the dog thinks this is a really silly name for a dog. Even in China, it's a really silly name for a dog.
It was a silly name, but again, he was a kid that, you know, he grew up rather freely in the countryside, and nobody had taught any rules about, you know, the world to him. And he was a very good-natured kid, so he learned a few things about the world. He wanted to be a good child. So I think ear was just one of those things that it made sense to him. It didn't make sense to the world, which was very sad. And it was harmless. It was just a harmless name, but he was laughed at because he named his dog Ear.
Mm-hmm. Well, if he lived in Portland, nobody would bat an eye at a name like that for a dog or a cat.
Over there,
There's so much goes on in this book that if I try to talk about every little thing in the book, we're not going to get through it. Mm-hmm. Plus, there's a whole lot I don't want to give away. But I do need to talk about Kai and Han.
Yes.
Because Kai and Han, to me, Han is, did you know the term Red Prince?
Oh, no, I did not know that, the Red Prince.
A Red Prince is somebody whose parents There are Red Princesses also. His parents have done very well as party members, and they usually live in places like Shanghai, you know, where there's a lot of money in the economy, and they go to the best schools, and they go to Europe to buy clothing and all this kind of stuff.
Okay.
He's, in a small way, a Red Prince, Han's Kai's husband. Tell us about the two of them.
So Han, yes, as you said, you know, he was the only son of this powerful couple in this provincial town, and he had a very bright political future, and he was going to be the mayor, you know, the next mayor after, you know, the current mayor retired. And Kai had a very interesting upbringing. She came from a rather, you know, ordinary family, and her mother had ambition to, all her ambition was just to move from a brick house to an apartment building, which was a very modern thing. And so, but Kai was beautiful, and Kai was an actress, so she had been trained as an actress since she was 7, and she acted on stage all these heroines and the martyrs in revolutionary operas. And by the time she retired from the opera troupe, she needed a job, and she got this beautiful job, I mean, wonderful gig, you know, as a news announcer, so she could use her beautiful voice, and she was also pretty, so she married Han because she was pretty. She was desirable.
And Han's family is not necessarily doesn't think she was the best choice, but she's okay.
She was okay. You know, she had the birth. The first baby was a boy. You know, she was presentable.
Oh, Ming Ming.
Yeah, Ming Ming. Yeah.
Something happens. I don't want to go into the details of it because I don't want to. You know, we don't have time. Number one, but I also don't want to ruin the book for people. But at some point. And the thing that ties her together with Gu Shan, who's being executed, and Teacher Gu, is that Teacher Gu had them both in school when they were little girls. And, in fact, they may have been friends or at least just classmates.
Right. They were classmates, yes.
And Kai does something which is not a wise thing to do for a person in her situation, which is she starts thinking about how she got where she got and how Gu Shan got where she got and wonders what the difference between them is.
Right. In a way, she was, you know, both in the novel, you know, and in real life, they kind of echoed each other. You know, they had different life experiences. And Kai, of course, she was, again, she thought a lot. You know, she did not think when she got married, but she started to think. And once someone starts thinking, you know, then, you know, she has a lot of questions. And she started to question everything about her life.
And that's what happened to Gu Shan, in fact, going from a vicious Red Guard to a counter-revolutionary. Counter-revolutionary is a very bad word.
Apparently, yes.
There are a lot of casual cruelties in this book. It's just cruelty seems to be an undercurrent running through this book, whether it's the cruelty of the government or the cruelty of the people to each other. And I'm sitting here thinking, I don't know much about Chinese rural culture, certainly. I know maybe a little more about Chinese culture in the big cities, maybe a little bit more about the emperors, you know, that kind of a thing. Is China a cruel culture? I mean, I'm looking at this from a Western point of view, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to have that bias. But and was it made worse by the Cultural Revolution?
You know, I would not say it has a cruel culture, though it does have the history of, you know, things are looked upon a little bit differently, apparently, from Western standard. I can give you an example. You know, when I grew up, I was a very young girl, and my grandfather lived with us, and he would teach, you know, history to me as like a 3 or 4 year old girl, and he would say, in this famine in 1582, in this city, people exchanged their children so they could eat other people's children, so they would not go starving. And that's, I'm sure that happened in history, but that was the kind of thing that people thought was normal to teach a four-year-old girl. So it was not cruelty, it was just a different standard, I would say. But I did agree, I think Cultural Revolution really did, I believe it really did bring out, you know, the cruel nature of human beings. When you are not treated nicely, you turn around and you treat the next person really horribly, and animals, and especially animals. I think that's a sign of how people treat animals. Also, it's a sign of how people would treat other human beings.
The crap always flows down, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know.
And winds up on the people least able to bear it.
Yeah.
Although in the book, there are any number of Chinese aphorisms, sayings, wisdoms wisdoms both from the communist country and from the old Confucian society.
Right.
And one of them is that you never get anything that you can't handle, that whatever you're given is something you can probably bear. And I think they tell that to the Gu's, Teacher Gu and Mrs. Gu,
yeah,
that although the daughter's life and death has been a tragedy, this is something that they can bear up and just go on because they're in the great communist, People's Republic of China, where the Communist Party is never wrong.
It's very interesting in that way. It's both very atheistic and also very fatalistic. You know, if you can have a good life, oh, wait for the next one. But where's the next one? I don't know. People would just always, think better of their lives.
This book was fascinating in many, many ways. I enjoyed that you're a good writer.
Thank you.
But also the glimpse into a country twisted out of shape, a culture twisted out of shape by a failed revolution. And I think in many ways it was a failed revolution. Mm-hmm. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. It didn't raise up the peasants. It didn't make everybody equal under the red flag. What it did was it created new hierarchies and new ways for people to be abused. I learned a lot about China.
Thank you.
I suppose if there's a question in there somewhere, is what were you attempting to do with this book? Was it simply to tell us this relatively simple story, or do you feel like you want people to understand China and you?
I did not start thinking about I was going to write a book about China so people could understand the time or China. I guess I had much less ambition than that. In a way, I think I was just curious about why people behaved certain ways. And this novel, the story was this, outbreak and was this execution. It was a perfect canvas for me as a novelist just to look at the town, look at every character and see why he or she did things the way he did or she did. So it was more just out of fascination about human beings. And I think the fact that it was set in China in 1979 was kind of like a byproduct because I had to make up this world to explain my fascination with these people.
So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
I think I'm about to wrap up another collection of stories and set in modern China, contemporary China, in 2008. And both, people in the cities and in the rural area. And next, after this book, and after the collection, I think I'm going to do a novel.
Excellent. Well, please come back with your books. We'd love to talk to you again.
Oh, I would love to come back anytime. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Again, let me remind you that the title of the book is The Vagrants. The author is Yun Li, Y-I-Y-U-N-L-I, published by Random House. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ed.
Listening to KBOO Portland, a Thursday morning radio zine for Thursday, March 26th. It's approximately 11:30 about now. And coming up next, Ava Lake interviews Karen Coulter of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. She speaks about saving trees in eastern Oregon. All that coming up this morning on KBOO. And then it's a Radio Free Ireland with Per Fager. And stay tuned. Oh, I forgot to mention, we are having a mailer today. We need your help. Come on down to 20 Southeast States, Mini Hands, Make Light Work, and we need some help today mailing out our monthly program guide. Come support KBOO in this special way. Come down to 20 Southeast States, and until about 4:30 today, we'll be
putting labels on things and getting our program guides ready to mail out. You can call 503-231-8032 for more information, or you can just drop by. Stay tuned now for an interview with Karen Coulter of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for listening to the Thursday Morning Radio Zine. My name is Ava Lake, and today we're going to be talking about the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. And what they have got going is a benefit, which is happening tomorrow night. That's at Liberty Hall, which is at 311 North Ivy Street, and it starts at 8 o'clock. And there's going to be some bands there. We're going to talk about that. Who I've got with me today is Karen Coulter. She is the director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. This is a group that has been successfully fighting for the preservation of forests and wildlife in eastern Oregon for nearly 20 years. They collaborate with ranchers and foresters and build important bridges in rural communities. They also offer internships during the summer months, which we're going to be talking about, where people can help monitor timber sales to help protect eastern Oregon forests. A little bit more about this benefit show that is tonight. There's an admission of $5 to $20 sliding scale. And if you want more information about this benefit or these summer internships, you can call 541-385-9167. That's 541-385-9167. Karen Coulter, thanks so much for joining us on KBOO.
Sure, thank you.
So I want to just kind of go over first a little bit what you are known for, and then we can kind of backtrack a little bit with that. From what I understand, your group has helped stop timber sales. You mentor new groups with activist skill workshops. You train mm-hmm. activists. You initiate conferences. And you've also published a primer. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah, the booklet is called The Rule of Property. Mm-hmm. And basically the mission of Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is not only to protect and restore biodiversity of wild species and ecological integrity in eastern Oregon, but also to address the root causes of ecological and community instability. So the booklet is addressing that. It's talking about the development and changes in property concepts and the rise of corporate power, starting with the English enclosure movement and up to the founding of this country. And right now I'm working on a sequel to that that's going to go all the way through the 19th century and extrapolate some lessons for activism now.
So what you're telling us is this book is a history of sorts,
uh-huh.
is a history that maybe hasn't been written before, or been written quite this way.
Well, basically, I'm taking a lot of existing history from different movements and different aspects of these periods mm-hmm. and synthesizing lessons from those for activism today and parallels between what happened then and what's happening now, how these problems that we have today, like financial meltdown, corporate solutions to climate change and so forth, where those problems came from and why they're so embedded in our culture as problems. And so I'm taking a lot of history and synthesizing it down into booklet form so anyone could pick up one of these and read it in a relatively short time.
Okay, where can we get these books? How can one get one of those?
You can call me at that number, 541-385-9167, mm-hmm. or visit the POCLAD website, which is www.poclad.org, which stands for the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, which is the other organization I work with. Or also get them from Apex Press.
Well, while we're on the subject of the book, I'm curious, like, how do you do your research? I imagine you're someone who's on site quite a bit. You're probably out in the community a lot. Are mm-hmm. you also in the library? Are you talking to people? Like, how did you get your research for this?
Well, that's an interesting question because people who know me realize that I don't tend to be online. I don't tend to use
right.
computers. Out where I live, I have no electricity, no computer. So actually, for this latest booklet, I actually went to Powell's and went through their entire shelves of 19th century history and pulled relevant books. And Powell's, fortunately, has a lot of used books, so that wasn't as expensive as it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a lot of activist contacts and asked them for pertinent information and so forth. So I did it mostly not online, mm-hmm. mostly through books I'm physically reading.
Great. And well, did you find, though, there was a real need for this kind of thing? Like, when you started writing it, was there sort of gaps in the modern mm-hmm. day, a modern day viewpoint on what happened?
Oh, definitely. U.S. citizens in the world, well, there's other countries, too, probably with this problem, but tend to be very ignorant of history, and the history we're taught in schools has an awful lot of gaps in it. It's mainly the conqueror's view of history rather than the oppressed people's view or nature's point of view.
Absolutely, yes. Uh-huh. It's very imperialist.
Yeah.
And that's still all right there. I mean, these struggles are still all right there in Eastern Oregon, you're telling us. We're still big need to have a watchdog and to see what's going on there.
Oh, definitely. Eastern Oregon is getting to be like a third world country. The communities are really hard pressed economically because it's been a real boom bust cycle with logging where the big timber corporations came in and wiped a lot out on the forest. And now the communities are struggling to survive and figure out where to go from here. And so that's actually provided an opening for us to have a dialogue for the first time where they're inviting me to the table, and I'm actually trying to collaborate with them to try to find common ground and move things towards ecologically sound restoration. It's a difficult process, however.
Well, but this is kind of interesting because I would imagine, okay, 20 years ago when you started doing this, maybe you were really seen as the enemy.
Right.
But because of this meltdown, mm-hmm. this corporate meltdown, that's now changing.
Well, it takes a lot of face-to-face contact to break down those stereotypes, and I realized I had stereotypes in my head about people in these rural communities, and they had stereotypes, of course, of me as being this evil
outsider,
lawsuit perpetuator that was stopping everything, slowing everything down. I think they're starting to realize that actually the Forest Service operates quite slowly, and we haven't really been slowing that much, but we have waged a number of successful lawsuits, and that's why they wanted me at the table, because they realized that I did have the power to stop things through my organization, Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. But now that we're at the table together, I really respect these communities for having a lot of good faith and trying to come up with common ground, trying to work with me. There's a lot of mutual respect developing. And the situation is still very tenuous, but I'm hoping that we can work together and democratize forest management into a more restoration direction.
Can you give us just an example of something that you're working on now that's like right front and center for you, that's an important thing that needs to be like a particular project that you're working on right now?
Sure.
That's important?
Sure. There's the collaborative groups, and then there's also, I'm still doing lawsuits on timber sales. I'm still needing volunteers in particular to help field check these timber sales, because every summer I physically cover thousands of acres of timber sales, proposed timber sales, on the ground in order to get valuable information about what the conditions are, what it would look like with what they're planning to do, what wildlife species are there, what plants that may be sensitive, whether they're breaking any laws with the way they're planning it, and so forth. The information gathered by volunteers goes into our comments, our appeals, our negotiations, and finally our lawsuits, and really gives us a lot of credibility with both the Forest Service and the courts. So I do need interns, volunteers this summer. One of the particular projects I'm working on right now is we're preparing for potential litigation on a sale called Farley in the Umatilla National Forest, and it's a higher elevation sale where they've done a lot of clear cutting in the past, and now they're aiming for cutting down a lot of the last remaining patches of what I would call old growth. They don't call it old growth, but there's old growth dependent species using it, like pileated woodpeckers and other number of other woodpeckers. And then another factor is that it's high elevation and there's a lot of lodgepole pine and a lot of snowshoe hare, which means that it's potential foraging habitat for Canada lynx, which are a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. And it's real close to the North Fork John Day Wilderness, which means that lynx could be there. And then it's mostly downhill slopes towards Desolation Creek, which flows into the North Fork John Day River and its critical steelhead habitat. And they admit there would be a lot of sediment from road construction, from cutting hazard trees, even from decommissioning roads that aren't very good to be there. But a lot of sediment could potentially go into the streams and go downstream and affect the fish habitat. So we're concerned about that because they haven't quantified how much sediment it would be. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know exactly what the impacts would be. It's also a very popular recreational use area and hunting area for elk. So that's an example of a case where we might go to court.
And so what, like if I was, let's say, wanting to volunteer for you or to train with you or help you in some way, what would someone be doing as regards like a project like that?
Right.
You're going out and checking out exactly what's happening, what they are doing. Because from what I'm hearing, people don't actually, they're going ahead and doing things without having it all cleared and being absolutely certain that it's safe or that it's right.
Well, what happens is that essentially the Forest Service is under unrealistic expectations from Congress, where they expect a certain amount of timber volume to come out, but Congress isn't going out there and seeing if that's sustainable on the ground, and it really isn't anymore. Mm-hmm. It never really was a sustainable level of logging. Due to past levels of overlogging, we're now in the situation where very little is sustainable at all because they cut down most of the old growth. They did a lot of clear cutting and so forth. So what a volunteer would physically be doing is going out with me hiking and camping out in the woods. It's actually a lot of fun. Quite often there's several people, and so it's like a party at night. And going out all day and doing hiking, which can be strenuous, and looking at timber sale units with us, mm-hmm. and recording information both on paper, on clipboards with survey sheets, and also taking photographs. And I train the volunteers. They don't have to have any experience at all to do this. And they can come for any period of time during the summer from basically mid-May through September. And the longer they stay, of course, the more they learn and the more different kinds of forest situations they see and the more wildlife they see. And you do see a lot of wildlife out there. It's not quite as dense as the west side, so you're able to see a lot more.
And do you find, okay, you've been doing this program for a very long time. Do you find that it changes personal lives, or I don't know, personal lives is maybe mm-hmm. not the right word, but people have this experience and they're never the same afterwards.
Yeah, I do find that, in fact. It's a very popular volunteer program. I've had people who've come from places like Washington, D.C., who have never slept in the woods before at all, who are completely mesmerized by the experience. I had a woman who had been subject to a lot of sexual abuse through her life, a lot of domestic abuse, and she came out of the whole summer feeling stronger and has gone on in a good way. And she was already trying to bring herself around. I've had a number of volunteers who go on and work for other environmental organizations, including one who became the executive director of a new organization he helped found in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And so people take this experience and apply it wherever they feel passionate. You know, a forest ecosystem somewhere else or some other kind of ecosystem. And I've had a lot of good reports of people going on and taking these skills elsewhere.
So, for instance, this benefit that is happening tomorrow night, this is to help fund these ventures. This is mm-hmm. where our money goes.
Yeah, and it's also to acquaint people with the organization and get them to see pictures of the forests involved and see if they'd like to volunteer with us this summer.
Great. So when we go, so just to remind the listener, it is tomorrow night at Liberty Hall, which is at 311 North Ivy Street. There is a benefit for Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. Sliding scale admission, $5 to $20. And if you want more information, you can call 541-385-9167. I've been talking with Karen Coulter. I'd like to ask you, what drew you to this area? You've been there, what, 19 years now?
Uh-huh.
20 years now?
19.
There must have been a seminal moment, what was it
uh-huh.
What started you?
Well, I grew up in Nevada, which is very similar to Eastern Oregon. I moved out here, went to school at Reed College in Portland. I was actually born in Portland and then traveled around quite a bit, but primarily grew up in Nevada. And I started having health problems on the west side. I'm allergic to some of the trees and molds and so forth out here. And so with my partner at the time, we went looking for land, and we went down to Nevada, and that was too much for him. And we didn't find very good land either. And then we went back through Eastern Oregon, and we just kind of went, huh, this is interesting. We could live with this. It's like a compromise. It is closer to the west side where my son lives, his sons lived, you know, my mother lives, and a lot of friends of ours out here. Mm-hmm. But it's still on the dry side of the mountains, which is easier for my health. And so anyway, we looked for land, and I found this one place and went to check it out and fell in love with it. It was in May, and there were wildflowers blooming everywhere and a beautiful view, and bought it and took a big risk because it's very economically depressed. I had no idea how I'd support myself out there.
Right, right. Do you find that since it is over on the east side and all of that people tend to forget it? Or?
Oh, yes. It's a political sacrifice zone because most of the population of Oregon is on this side of the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the political influence is over here. Like one congressperson there covers an enormous area with very low population. And most of the people are dependent on resource exploitation, which is why I say it's very similar to a third world situation now where the boom and bust, you know, the bust has already happened. People are struggling And to a large extent, their problems are forgotten. And
yes.
So I'm sympathetic with that as well.
Right. It's a kind of a back and forth negotiation
mm-hmm.
that happens. Maybe just a little bit about this event tomorrow night. Tell us about the bands that are playing or what
sure.
people can expect to hear.
Yeah, Underscore Orchestra is playing, and that is like a gypsy band, sort of an Eastern European band, very
nice.
Danceable, fun, very popular band. Dapper Cadavers are playing. They're like a jug band, again, a well-known band in Portland area. And Slow Teeth is like a banjo and other instrumental combination, a smaller group. And so they'll all be playing. And then we also have a silent auction with a number of donated items to be auctioned off, including a Thai meal, including eco paint, including books, homemade wine, all kinds of
nice.
Things. And, yeah, all kinds of interesting stuff. And then we have photo displays of some of the timber sales forests at risk right now.
Correct.
And we have books and literature and ways to find out how you can help and a short presentation about our work.
And you don't have a website now, but you will be.
We will soon, yeah.
You will be soon. Well, I'm curious, like, how you're able to manifest all of this and organize all of this. I mean, these days everybody is sort of, you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, blogging and Twittering.
Right.
You are able to organize all of this without that.
Well, I've been an activist since about 1980, and none of the activists had websites or computers or whatever then, so I'm used to that. And then
uh-huh.
I live where there's no electricity, so it's actually difficult for me to go in and use the internet. I don't have any internet access where I live.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, from my point of view, I've had to use the internet more because some funders insist on an online process. Some of the research is more easily accessible that way, and so forth and so on. So Free Geek was nice enough to donate a laptop and a printer. I still don't have internet access on my land, and I still won't be accessible that way very much because most of the summer I'm actually out in the field. But
right.
More and more, it's hard to avoid using it at all. I'm kind of a Luddite and
sure.
enjoy living without electricity.
Yes. But I'm sure you've heard about how all these people were able to like avoid problems and what have you through Twitter on a demonstration. Like they all communicated with each other simultaneously about like where roadblocks were, where the police
oh, yeah.
were, and were able to like organize all these things that would have been unheard of just a few years ago.
Yeah, I'm familiar. I'm not real familiar with that, but I know how it's being used. But I think it's overblown as well because
okay.
I was part of the Seattle WTO protest organizing,
mm-hmm.
and now it's being portrayed as without the internet, it would have been impossible. I beg to differ with that because I did a lot of face-to-face organizing, and so did a great number of other people prior to that event.
Well, tell us a little bit about it. Have you been on KBU and talked about this part before? Or
I don't remember if I've talked
kind
about
of,
this.
It's got to be kind of a. I mean, I would like to just hear about your experience just for a few minutes.
Well, the funny thing about it is I'd lived in Seattle before, and so did my partner, who's also involved in the organizing. And I didn't really think that the choke point strategy would necessarily work in terms of physically preventing the delegates from getting in. I was a little skeptical, but it did, and I helped with that on the street, actually. And it was extremely exciting. I think the most exciting moment to me was the Tuesday morning, the day of the big direct action, when at about 10:30 in the morning, I looked around and realized it wasn't just activists blocking the street anymore. There was an outpouring of ordinary people from the city all mm-hmm. over. And I could hear their conversations, and I could see that they blocked the street with us. And then when the tear gas came in, they'd clear the street. And then when it cleared again, they'd go back out in the street. And that was fantastic.
Yes.
That's when you know things are really starting to turn around. The other thing that I thought was extremely important about that protest is we were actually targeting an institution leveraging corporate power, the World Trade Organization.
Yes.
And one of the books I've helped put out, George Drafin wrote it, and I funded it, and it was my idea. It's called The Elite Consensus, and it's a citizen's guide to the institutions leveraging corporate power, because a lot of people know about institutions like the World Trade Organization or WTO, but they're not familiar with a lot of other ones based in the U.S. that could be opposed and spotlight thrown on them,
mm-hmm.
such as the Business Roundtable and a number of others. So this book is very useful for that, and it's going to be on sale at the benefit, too.
Great. So this is also making me wonder just like how have you seen things change since you
mm-hmm.
did just say, well, come on, you know, people are still doing things without Facebook and Twitter and all
mm-hmm.
of that. All right. 20 years you've been doing this. I would like to just to hear from you, like how positive and negative changes, mm-hmm. how activism has changed. What you
sure.
think?
Well, for one thing, on forest activism, I started out actually more with the Earth First movement in the West Side and doing direct action. So I did kind of a reversal of what people usually do. Usually they follow the legal process and then they get frustrated with that and they turn to direct action. I kind of did the opposite because when we moved to Eastern Oregon, I realized the direct action wasn't going to work. There wasn't any support base for it locally. The sales were huge. There was a lot of road access. It just wouldn't work. So we turned to using the public process, which is called the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. And when we first started, there was incredible antagonism and polarization. I mean, we were pretty much blacklisted and threatened and harassed just for being environmentalists. And actually, I'm still not really considered part of the community simply because I'm an environmentalist out there, even though I've been living there for a long time. And we had things happen like people prowling around our land at night, lug nuts on our car being loosened, / tires. And the change that I've seen now is now that we've shown that we can stop timber sales with the lawsuits if they're, and this is legitimate. I mean, this is mm-hmm. judges saying they're illegal, and we pick and choose that. We don't go after every single timber sale with a lawsuit, but the most ecologically destructive ones. But once people in the local community saw that, and then things were getting very hard economically because a lot of the best forest is already gone economically,
mm-hmm.
and then the Forest Service started to get defunded from the Bush administration, then they invited us to the table. And so now we're talking, and now we're trying to shift the whole practice to ecologically sound restoration. And that takes a lot of relearning on the Forest Service's part, too. On other activism, just briefly, I think we had a big impact from 9/11 because the WTO protest was the start of a good trend. More targeting of institutions leveraging corporate power who hold us all under their thumb, the ecosystems and the communities. And then after 9/11, there was a lot more fear and a lot more persecution and a lot more stereotyping and, of course, detention of thousands of people just for looking Middle Eastern.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to recover from that and regain our strength and get strong as a movement again and bring back that vibrant movement against global corporatization in a stronger way, I think. And so
you're saying there's been some kind of distraction. People have been sort of looking. And even maybe this economic crisis and what have you is in a way a kind of distraction.
Well, it's actually an opportunity, too, because I think then people will see that the way things have been going don't work. Financial speculation doesn't work. There's a lot of problems with capitalism itself. I think it provides an opening for a lot stronger activism addressing the root causes of the issues.
And do you feel like this particular new administration, is that helping you? Is that an optimistic slant for you, or does it almost not touch you?
I think it goes both ways. On the one hand, under President Clinton, the Forest Service felt a little easier about negotiating with us. We brought one timber sale from 53 million board feet down to 5 without ever appealing or litigating. That would have been pretty impossible under the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives us a little breathing room. On the other hand, people are too ready to say, okay, Obama is our savior.
Yeah, they are.
And he has some pretty horrible economic and foreign policy advisors. He's sending more troops to Afghanistan. It's not a rosy picture. He may be better on some things, but he may be just as bad on others. So I think we have to be very vigilant and keep our activism strong in these days.
I'd also like to ask you, it seems to me you've got to know so much about the law. Do you have a lot of advisors, or is that part of your education? I mean, I think
uh-huh.
a big part of your strength is that you can actually get the law on your side.
Right.
Here. So how are you making that happen?
We were pretty much self-taught, and I'm referring to Sante Riverwind as well, who was the co-director of and founder of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project with me originally. We wrote all our own appeals at first, which meant we had to research the law. And people think that the law is a big deal, but actually some of these laws are very short booklets, like the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act. Anybody could read them and understand them. And then what we did is we went to other groups who'd written appeals, often with a lawyer's help, and we would feel free to draw case law from those appeals. Nowadays, what we tend to do for appeals is law students. For instance, at Lewis and Clark, write a lot of our appeals for practice on a volunteer basis.
How great is that? That's good.
That's wonderful.
That's good.
And a lot of our lawyers have really volunteered tremendous amounts of time to help us.
Are there other ways that you are training activists, for instance? I mean, you're having people come out with you, these internships.
Mm-hmm.
Are you known during the summer to help you with monitoring the land and seeing what's going on with timber sales? Are there other ways that you're actually, I mean, I suppose WTO is maybe a famous one,
uh-huh.
but there are other kind of ongoing ways?
I give workshops. Okay. I give speaking presentations. I'm going to be speaking actually about prisons, the prison industrial complex and prison corporatization.
Well, that's a big business.
Yeah, at Reed College in the evening on April 15th. I'm going to be speaking at the Evergreen Synergy Conference in May. I do speaking presentations. I give activist workshops. I'll be going to the Earth First National Rendezvous, which will be somewhere in southwest Oregon, not sure where yet, giving workshops there, and at a women and transgender action camp. Before that, I'll be giving workshops. So I give workshops on things like how to use the media, how to field check a timber sale, how to use the legal process, and on corporate power, of course.
Oh, just one kind of final big question. Mm-hmm. What is it that young people can do, or people that are interested can do? What is it that they can do that's not been done yet? I mean, you might have an idea in your head that's like, boy, if I could get around to this, I would.
Mm-hmm. Well, one issue that I think needs more attention is nanotechnology. There's been really strong activism around genetic engineering and very successful. If I had a head for it, I would work on nanotechnology. I'm really scared of it personally.
Well, what does this mean now? Give me what does that mean?
Well, like creating human cyborgs, starting to put machines in people, other aspects, micro surveillance, all kinds of things. And so issues like that. But I think the best advice I can give to new or younger activists is to follow your heart. Whatever you feel passionate about, you're likely to do better with your activism around. And to learn from other people. Don't feel embarrassed to ask lots of questions and do the grunt work.
If there was anything that you maybe could have done in the past, or like, what's the big maybe lesson that you were kind of still learning?
Well, I wish when I was at Reed that I'd actually studied subjects that I wasn't particularly as interested in the time. I studied English and history, and now I wish I'd taken physics and chemistry and things like that.
So
that's something to think about is what are you least likely to be able to study later in terms of time and money and so forth. And otherwise, I don't really have any great regrets. I'm glad I became an activist. It's been a lot of fun, and I intend to continue.
Yes, well, I've been talking with Karen Coulter, who is the director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, and they are having a benefit performance, which is happening tomorrow night at Liberty Hall. That's at 311 North Ivy Street. It starts at 8 p.m. The admission is $5 to $20 sliding scale. They've got playing. We have Underscore Orchestra, the Dapper Cadavers, and Slow Teeth. Plus, also there's lots of booklets and mm-hmm. all kinds of things that are for sale, yes?
Right, books and T-shirts and also a silent auction.
And if you want more information about this project or about the benefit or summer internships, which sound like a really good thing, how long do these last? I mean,
As long as somebody wants to come out, anywhere from a week to months. And usually the longer is better. Usually they average about 1 to 3 months, but it's pretty flexible according to people's needs.
And they can call 541-385-9167. So my name is Ava Lake, and thanks so much for listening to Thursday Morning Radio Scene.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, listener-sponsored community radio.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. More investigators are being hired at the Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division to try to correct a serious failing when it comes to enforcing wage laws. A government accounting office report revealed Wednesday documented seriously inadequate performance of the division in enforcing wage laws. So Labor Secretary Hilda Solis says 250 more investigators are being added to beef up enforcement to protect workers' wages. FedEx is threatening to cancel orders for $10 billion worth of Boeing jets if Congress passes labor reform that changes union rules covering FedEx workers.
The Teamsters Union says FedEx is apparently not content with cutting wages, raising its employees' medical insurance premiums, and wiping out pension benefits for its workers. Now the Teamsters say it's threatening to blackmail Congress. The Teamsters say that's a slap in the face to Congress and the American people. FedEx workers are covered under the Railway Labor Act, which gives unions less clout and employers more power. Pending legislation in Congress that's part of the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization would put many FedEx workers under the National Labor Relations Act that covers most other private sector workers. Today is an important day for the city of Chicago as city leaders make a bid to host the 2016 Olympic Games. Jesse Russell reports.
Chicago is one of the final four cities in a competition that also includes Madrid, Rio de Janeiro, and Tokyo. Chicago wants the gig because the Olympics won't act only as a showcase for the Midwestern city, but also as a job creator and economic stimulant. City representatives will make the case in Denver starting today at an event called Sports Accord. Chicago 2016 President Lori Healy says Chicago has a distinct advantage because of the city's diversity.
You know, the members of the IOC represent the entire world. And when you come to Chicago, you can find typically someone from that community that lives here.
According to Healy, the Olympics won't only be a generator for the Chicago region, but also the entire Upper Midwest.
Every place that's got a college campus or college university that has athletic facilities will likely be used as a training and acclimatization facility by a country coming in ahead to have their athletes train, get used to being here, get used to the time for a period of time.
Here is today's economic report. Realtors are breathing a sigh of relief as news about new home sales in February came out better than expected. New home sales across the country jumped by 4.7% in the second month of the year. The level of homes sold is still the second lowest on record, and sales were down 43.8% since the same time last year. The inventory of unsold homes on the market is still gargantuan, with a 12-month supply glutting the market.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Thursday, March 26th. Welcome British filmmaker and programmer Ben Rivers for a night of screening of his much-acclaimed 16mm films. Beyond Borders Program 1 is screening tonight at Cinema Project, located at 11 Northwest 13th Avenue, 4th floor, in downtown Portland between Burnside and Cooch Streets. Doors open at 7 p.m. The show starts at 7:30. There will be a suggested donation at the door. For more information, visit the web at cinemaproject.org. It's Books to Prisoners monthly mailing night tonight from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Help send books to prisoners who are only allowed to receive new books. Meet at 6315 Northeast Rodney Street in Portland. For more information, call 503-740-4375. That's 503-740-4375. Get involved in mailing books to prisoners. Help your community while getting some new trees. The Kiwanis Club of Damascus Boring is offering its annual tree sale fundraiser from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on March 28th and 29th and April 4th and 5th, offering shade, flowering, and fruit-bearing trees. The event will be held at Westcott's parking lot. That's at 19701 Southeast Highway 212 in Damascus, Oregon. For more information, call 503-806-3739. That's 503-806-3739. And this has been the Community Calendar. I'm Alicia Olson for KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, the Columbia Gorge, and Corvallis. Visit us at kboo.fm.